I'm Mike Burr, and this is a session called Family Values, Biblical Data on a Political Shibboleth. Okay, now, does anybody know what this is about? If you do, let me know. Just to give you a little background on myself, I'm a parish pastor in Moscow, Idaho, which is a university community. Serve a combined American Baptist and Disciples of Christ church there. Kind of a small church, average attendance of about 75. But in the last 4 or 5 years have been working on a Doctor of Ministry degree through the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California, specifically through San Francisco Theological Seminary, which is a Presbyterian school. So I'm a Baptist going to a Presbyterian school talking at a Lutheran retreat center, and we should all get along fine. But my focus of interest over the past few years has been on the specific area of ministering to blended families or step families. And it has been through this work that I've come to do some biblical work on looking at the biblical understanding of a family, and want to share some of that this evening. Part of my interest in doing that is that currently there is a lot of talk about family values. It is a political catchphrase, and for those of you who don't know what a shibboleth is, I didn't know till I looked it up about 2 days ago. A shibboleth is just that. It is a political catchphrase that is used to connote a lot more than it really says. And and so, you know, want to spend some time looking at what our biblical tradition has to say about family and family values. The recent Republican convention had several ministers who talked about family, and seems to be an identification in some people's mind of a certain kind of family with the Bible. Want to talk about that some. Now, don't know about you, but when people start talking about family and the traditional family, what kind of comes to mind is the father worker, mother homemaker, 2.2 kids, living in suburbia, one cat, 1.3 dogs. And that's come to be kind of an American image of what the family is, what the family should be. And, before I go any further, let me just say I don't want to make this a lecture. You know, if you have comments or questions, would appreciate it if you would raise your hand, you know, so we can keep some kind of order. But let's make this a discussion as much as possible. But Anybody have an idea of how long that image of the family has really been operative in our country?
Ozzie and Harriet.
Ozzie and Harriet, okay.
Leave it to Beaver.
Father knows best. These are all real typical cultural expressions of this image.
That image, from what I read, has been around less than about 75 years.
Less than 75 years, right. Right. Actually, it really got its emphasis after World War II. After World War II. Alan Toffler, kind of a sociologist, historian, talks about the nature of this nuclear family. And one of the things that he points out is that during World War II, you know, a lot of men went off to war. Any people here among that group that went off to war? Yeah, a couple here. And what happened was simultaneously there was an urbanization of America as people moved towards urban centers, and also a movement of women into the workforce. There weren't men around to work, so women started working in the factories. The end of World War II came, and there was a flood in the country of GIs, and they needed jobs. And that was one of the impetuses to this development of this nuclear family. You know, it became a little more unacceptable for the woman to be working. She should be back home. Make job room for the man. But before that time, what the notion of the family was the extended family. People grew up in agrarian, agricultural communities, and they grew up around mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles and cousins, and it was this extended family that was the norm. It's the kind of family that I was born into in southern Idaho. There's still remnants of it in that rural culture there. So the idea of the nuclear family is really quite recent, and when we talk about family values, we really need to understand that. Yeah.
Tell me, what does nuclear have to do with it?
The nuclear family is the nucleus family. The core family. It was called as the mother, father, children. And as opposed to the extended family. Okay, but we start looking at the Bible as a way to help us understand the family. One of the things that we have to understand is that this image of the nuclear family is not found in the Bible. It's not a biblical concept. Either in the Old Testament or in the New Testament. Old Testament. Any idea of what the sense of family there was?
Clan or tribe,
Right.
They have a patriarch. A patriarchal family, and he was head of this whole
clan or a tribe. Right. Old Testament uses a couple words for the family. Hebrew, mishpaha and bayith, two of the most popular words. Always mean this sense of extended family clan, centered around a central male figure, the father figure. So what the family consisted of was the patriarch, father figure, his wife, wives, his concubines, his sons and their wives, his daughters till they were married, grandchildren, slaves, servants, and strangers, people who might come in and be accepted in to the clan. And that was the sense of a family. You know, that was the understanding of a family.
During the late 30s and in the during the 40s, there was a radio program called One Man's Family.
Mm.
That Father Barber was the patriarch of the family, and it described in all of the activities and the broken hearts and all of the trials and tribulations that they went through, and he was the head, the umbrella of that family. And that was what was portrayed at that time. And that radio program, I believe, went off of the air just about the time television came.
Yeah, it was still going in the early 50s. Uh-huh. Yeah, so this sense of the patriarchal family is something that has been handed down. In different forms. The New Testament continues the same kind of understanding of a family. A couple words that New Testament uses: patria, oikos, oikia, Greek words. None of them refer to what we understand as nuclear family, as this nucleus core family of the mother, father, children, and 1.3 dogs. So what does it mean when somebody says, well, let's get back to the biblical family, to the biblical notion of the family. Does that mean going back to Abraham? Let's see, where women are property. Men can have two or three wives, several concubines. Is that what we mean? Where children are,
Does the scripture say something about for this cause a man shall leave his father's house and his mother and cleave to his wife,
mm-hmm.
and the two shall become as one? Is that a family? Is that what we're trying to get to?
I don't know. Is it?
Well, I think it is. I think that's what the scripture in the New Testament indicates, so that is family.
Okay, so there's this very basic sense of man and woman coming together,
right,
which underlies the sense of the extended family, or the sense of the patriarchal family, which acts as kind of a core. Okay.
Doesn't that last statement sound more like a matriarchal family? That the man leaves his father and mother and turns to his wife?
Could be.
It's interesting that that came into the New Testament in such a patriarchal society.
But again, yes,
Carl. I want to call attention. It was quoted in the New Testament, but it already appears in Genesis.
Right.
So that when God creates man and woman, the word is there that that man should leave his father and mother. Verse 24 of chapter 2, right? Therefore a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh, the man and his wife were both naked. So this was before there were even any children around. So that was a principle. There was only one man, one woman. But they got over that real fast.
But the important part here, I think, is what is developed in the history of human relationship is this notion of covenant between man and woman as they come together. It's this sense of marriage, this sense of bonding, man and woman to together that forms a core, I think, of our understanding of a family. Yeah, Bill.
It's from that sort of basic concept that I heard what I thought to be best definition of family for our day, and that is that a family is a circle of people who love you.
Family is a circle of people that love you.
You're bonded together by that love.
Okay.
That is open-ended to form.
But is that, you know, is that our normal understanding of family? Usually we understand a family as blood.
There's another definition, something about when you go away and come back, the family is where they have to take you back.
Other people have a choice, but the family has to take you back. Huh? Okay, yeah, over here.
Yes, but on the notion of a family implying a blood relationship, I do a lot of work with foster families, and certainly those ties can be as close as any you see in a blood relationship. Or the same with, I do a lot of work with adoptions, and the same thing, the closeness, and I would agree with the gentleman over here that it's the sense of love and the giving to each other and kind of the belonging to each other that bears a lot on the sense of family.
Okay, so it's the sense of love. You know, if you remember when I started, I said that I got into this by working with step families. You know, it's another family situation where there's not that sense of blood.
Well, and sometimes blood families can be the most bitter places.
Fights.
The most bloody.
The most bloody.
Uh-huh.
Family feuds that go on, and that can be a horrible place that you wouldn't even want to call a family other than the fact that they're related by blood.
Okay.
I think almost all of us have had the experience too that when it's a family affair and, you know, we say, oh, I shouldn't be here, and they say, oh, you're family. So that it's, and yet it doesn't seem to have the legal status. And so where the legal aspect comes in with adoption papers and stuff, that's fairly recent and it's very complicated. And most of the laws that we have, by the way, come from a Christian community asking for those kind of laws. And then we tell the people, as a good Christian, you ought to obey the law.
Okay, so, another comment here.
Back to your other remark, Don't you believe the difference between the family in the Old Testament and the New? One of the reasons for the many wives and so forth was that whole be fruitful and multiply. But then in the New Testament, it's one man, one woman. You don't find the multiple wives in the New Testament. At least I can't recall any. You have another idea. I think this idea of losing the mother, father, children core, a lot of that came about when Jesus, they approached and said, oh, your mother and brothers are about. And he said, who are my mother and brothers? It was the people who were accepting him. So I think in the Christian community, we say that we're a family because we all have Jesus. So we say you can meet a group like here at Holden and feel very close. We're a family. That's where that idea of the love. But another interesting point is you can disinherit your own child, but you cannot disinherit an adopted child. So that's where the law came in.
Okay. You guys are great. You're just going right down my list here. Just to point out that in the New Testament, family relationship, man-woman relationship. Woman was still considered property, owned by the man. Children, still considered property, owned by the father. What Jesus does is revolutionizes things. In some ways, turns things on their head. And you were getting at it with the verse that you quoted over.
Well, I think people think of Jesus as being the first women's liberator.
Anybody here? Yeah.
For his culture,
he was. Yeah. We can take a couple different passages. Passage on divorce, for instance, very often used, to say that Jesus was saying that there was an absolute prohibition on divorce. I personally don't to read it like that. I read it as Jesus addressing a social problem within the context of the culture. Had a situation where women were considered property. A man could divorce his wife for cause. That meant that if he found her unacceptable, he could write a writ of divorce, which consisted of writing on a paper, I believe, three times that he divorced her. And she was put out of the home, disenfranchised, disowned. There was no legal protection in terms of community property. If the woman wasn't accepted back into her house, she was on the street. And so Jesus was addressing an injustice there. That was doing violence to women. Yeah.
Something else was going on in the Old Testament. Ever since God made the promise to Abraham that in his seed would all the nations of the earth be blessed, seed got to have an awfully important bit of attention. So much so that our holiest concept of Old Testament family gets all messed up. The idea was that if there was going to be a baby, the power was all with the man. When you read
in the
old man dying, his strength was still with him. That meant he was still capable of fertilizing the egg, except they didn't know that there was an egg. They regarded the woman as sort of a nest, which the man put it in there and thought it, so it was all man. They even have this, you know, if it wasn't a male child, that would be a real sad thing. If the oldest male brother in the family died before his wife could bring forth a baby, it was the duty of the next son to get her pregnant, and it would belong. But there's so much emphasis on his seed. One place in Deuteronomy, they have a picture of a man struggling, having a fight with another man, and his wife comes to his rescue. She grabs the scrotum of the man who is attacking her husband. If she does this, because that's the seed of his, the place of his seed, her hand shall be cut off. I mean, that, you know, we don't pay much attention, and we're just horribly offended. All that's trying to focus is on the importance that those people put on seed. And of course, when Jesus arrives on the scene, he upsets the whole thing. He is the seed. And so he talked about, your people talk about you being sons of Abraham? Forget it. So that's where the turning point really comes theologically for Israel.
And this is the turning point in terms of what constitutes family. Because in the old, well, throughout scriptures, we have the whole notion of the people of God. Who are the people of God? You know, who constitutes the family of God? In the Old Testament, it is blood related. It is the tribes of Israel. It is the people of, it's the chosen people. These are the people of God. But with Jesus, this gets turned on its head. And there is this universalization of the family of God. Jesus' mother and brothers come to pull him away from all of this nonsense that he's doing with healing people and teaching and stuff. And there's this crowd all around him. And his disciples say, well, you know, your mother and brothers are here. And he says, these, whoever does the will of my Father in heaven, that person is my mother and my brother and my sister. And so it universalizes and spreads out this sense of who is family. Okay, you had a...
Going back to Abraham, I just thought it interesting to note that Sarah was the important one in God's plan. Abraham had other seed, Hagar, but Sarah was the important one that God had planned to be the mother of the chosen race.
God knew that, but the men didn't want to take that too seriously.
Right.
Abraham had other seed, but Sarah's child was the one who God was pleased with, and whom God intended should be the father of the nations, mother of the nations.
Okay, over here.
Getting back to kind of what he said too, all the chronology going back was always so-and-so begat so-and-so and so, and usually it was the male, and even, isn't it in Matthew too, because traces his genealogy back to Jesse, you know.
Except in a couple of places.
Yeah.
Rahab
and
Ruth.
Yeah. But generally, when anyone had children, they always went back. And they didn't always list the women to the girls.
Well, just to prove things haven't changed an awful lot, in our Lutheran church, we had a big debate when they were shaping the new liturgy. Well, now it's an old liturgy. About it in preference to the Lord's meaning, whether we should say by Abraham or by Abraham and Sarah. And the and Sarah lost by about 4 votes on a male dominated.
And we know which way it went.
But I go ahead and put it in. Some of us go ahead and put it in. should say, by Abraham and Sarah.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. She was in court, but
that loss, and that was only about. I knew a woman pastor who was fighting hard for that. She was very disappointed.
So the question then comes, how does the Bible inform us? Scriptural tradition inform us as to what is of value in the family?
There's a bill pending in Congress which seeks to define what a family is. And somewhat in keeping with what this gentleman says, if two people decide to live together and love each other and commit themselves to each other, that's family, whether it's two women or two men or whatever. They're going to recognize that as a family. I don't think Scripture recognizes that type as a family, even though they might love each other, whatever.
Okay.
Well, there have been laws in almost all the states for years that if a man and woman are cohabiting or living together for 6 or 7 years, that's regarded as a common law marriage, and people generally respect that. And it's not as if the day that they are married 6 or 7 years to comply with what the law says, but it's retroactively effective for the time that they started living together. So it can be documented when they lived together. So in one sense, that law has been around in a different form for a long time. And the church has pretty well gone along with that by way of sort of sanctifying, even without a benefit of a marriage ceremony.
In Idaho, it's all that it takes is for a man and woman to pass themselves publicly as husband and wife. They can have known each other for 10 minutes.
Really?
Yep. Yes.
I don't believe that common law marriage holds in the state of Washington. I don't believe it has any legal validity in the state, regardless of how long you might have been living together.
I'm not sure.
That a relative, a blood relative, but could, if a man and a woman were living together for 15 years and he died, as a wife, she would inherit his property. It's a community property state. But in this state, if he died and he had a brother that he hadn't seen in 30 years, that brother would inherit. I think that's the way it is.
Okay. I'd like to get back to this question that I posed. How does our biblical tradition inform us then as to how we are to live? What become the operative, the important family values? Yeah.
I see it from a personal standpoint as inclusive now, because I'm not traditional in the true sense anymore. And so I've changed my views, and I see the Bible as and inclusive. My family becomes everyone.
My family becomes everyone. Okay. And
I don't have to like everybody.
Uh-huh.
I don't have to love everybody. Well, I'm supposed to love everybody. But I don't have to like everybody, and I don't have to invite everybody to my home, or I don't have to go to people's homes. But
just like a blood family.
But I better love them. Now, I better love these people that are on this earth. And that's how I see it today.
Okay, so love becomes the important function. Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have a comment, Bill?
Well, they had a very difficult time in both East Africa and West Africa after the countries became independent there about 30 years ago in defining family. And it was because the Christian missionaries had come and said that the cultural forms of family, polygamy, were not valid. You could not be a Christian and be polygamous. And yet that was the method of maintaining the society for all kinds of economic and social reasons. And so they had a big in-depth look at scripture as African Christians. And they, after going through all the Old Testament and New Testament, they basically had to say that they were open to other forms, that there was no Christian form of marriage or a family, that the forms of family are developed culturally. But what our Christian faith does is shed a value system upon whatever system you find yourself in. And that should be, for example, in a polygamous situation, that the man can't just cast away one of the wives when he feels like it. But as a Christian who has two wives, he must care for both of them equally. And they went through, and I thought they did a pretty good job of distinguishing, because it's true, there's a lot of different forms of family in the world. And as we've heard, the nuclear family, which my wife and I set out to be a typical family when we got married in 65, of the same blood, mother, father, two kids. Now we find we're something like 7% of the families are that way today.
Right.
Is that still the right figure?
That's about it, yeah.
So we set out to be the typical, or the atypical.
Right.
So obviously,
but this
Christian faith sheds a value and values on whatever family setting we find ourselves in.
But now we're forgetting about what this gentleman brought up about two men becoming a family and having adopting children or whatever and become a family, or two women say they're married. And are we passed over that? But I think that's pretty important to discuss.
Okay.
Are we going to accept it? He said there was a law pending.
There is.
Law pending. Okay, I think one of the things that Bill brought out here is important, and it's part of what I was trying to get at the very beginning, and that is that in terms of form and structure of family, there's very little biblically that dictates, that says, this is the way that it should be. But rather, what we get, especially in the New Testament with Jesus, where Jesus says, person that does the will of God, the will of my Father, that person is my mother and brother and sister. Jesus says, what is the great commandment? To love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, with all your being, and to love your neighbor as yourself. So love becomes the operative, the important characteristic of relationships. And what happens in a family then is that I have children, but under Christ, I have to recognize that my child is my brother, is my sister. Does that make sense?
No,
that
doesn't
make sense.
Oh, good.
Where does it say that
that the reason for marriage was to have families and to multiply. Well, how can you multiply without a male and a female? So how can you have a family if there are two males, two females, or two females?
Well, can we just look at that first question? Is the purpose of all marriages to have children, or is it not good that man should be alone? And is the other a blessing? Some people love each other very much, and they cling to each other, and they can't possibly have children. Is that marriage then to be nullified?
No, obviously not.
Yeah. So we have to back off a little bit from that. Procreation is a blessing. The assignment of love.
That's right.
Okay, Bill?
Well, of course, in the issue of same-sex marriages, the reality is that we have them. They exist. But there are families that have formed where children have been adopted, children who otherwise would not have had a family. I know in Southern California, lesbians raise children, gay men raise children, and these families do exist. And so we're at the point in American history, at least, that we've got a variety of cultures that have given forth a variety of family structures and forms. And I don't know whether the government decides yes or no on it makes much difference, because the reality is that it exists. But from the Christian standpoint, what do we do about that or say about it? Are these families not welcome in our churches?
Yeah. And that's an issue that churches across the country, you know, are really struggling with. And that pastors, you know, have to struggle with.
Well, not all people that come to church are Christians. We would like to think so, mm-hmm. but who are we to judge?
That's true.
We can't judge that, but I can't see that we don't have to approve of everything that's going on. I mean, we certainly invite them to church. We want them in church. Maybe they get another understanding.
And maybe they come in and get accepted as part of family, and accepted as who they are, as being children of God, as being brothers and sisters.
But do we
in
accept them as a regular family, two men or two women with a family?
Well,
just
who do you accept as regular family? You know, that's part of what Bill was getting at, and I think part of, again, what we have to struggle with is church. That if our notion of regular family is that man and wife and the children, we're excluding a whole lot of people. We're excluding single parent families. You know, we're excluding blended families, step families.
What about us older people? Excluding
older families. Elmer. Yeah.
The issue of homosexuality ought to be faced frequently.
Yeah.
When I lived here at Holden, the three things that caused all kinds of problems in forums like this were homosexuality, abortion, and can the Jews be saved? Those three. Well, I want to recommend a tape. I don't know if anybody's been listening to tapes here, but Dan Spencer has a tape on homosexuality. He's a homosexual who's at Union Seminary in New York presently. He's been here many times. He lived here for quite some time. And his tapes on homosexuality are worth listening to, not because they will make you think differently than you do now, but you will hear from someone who has grown up in this kind of a situation what he believes from study of the scripture and lots of other stuff might be worth listening to. Being open, what Holden is about is being open to ideas we haven't heard before, And maybe listening to Dan Spencer, I always like people who come from it rather than us talking about what's it like over there. Let the people who are over there tell us what it's like. And Dan Spencer's tape here in the library is a great one. Thank you.
Yeah.
Part of the name of this this forum is political.
You're right.
Okay. Some of the political parties have realized that 10% of the adult population is homosexual, and that's 10% of the voting public.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a pretty sizable amount of people. Nationwide, worldwide, and
in this room,
and so the politicians pay attention to that. In Seattle, the politicians go to the gay community. They have their picture taken. They march in their parades.
And shouldn't the church maybe do that too?
I don't have a problem with it.
Well, if love means acceptance, to me that's what love is accepting others, my neighbor, then I think we have to accept other people who might have chosen some other way of living. We might not choose it for ourselves, we might not even approve of it, but I think we have to accept them and let God be the judge.
Yeah. And again, would come back to this notion that the sense of family that we need to operate with is the sense of the family of God. The sense that you and I are brothers and sisters. Because of what happened in this figure of Christ, in the revelation, there, we become brothers and sisters under God. The question then becomes, what is love? And how do we love one another? And how do we love this whole diverse, crazy family that we are a part of?
Can't on our own. I mean, I can't.
Okay, say more about that.
Oh, I don't know. I think I go back to Corrie Ten Boom when she was in prison, and the prisoners, what they put her through. And she couldn't forgive them or love them on her own, and I guess that's where we're at. I mean, I just couldn't right now, you know. To love, mm-hmm. To really say I love everybody, homosexuals, murderers, and all that, we can't. I mean, I can't, to be really honest. How many really could? Okay. If I had a love of Christ like that, that's a big issue.
Mm-hmm. How many people love themselves? Because I mean that verse, and then I keep asking myself at home, how can you love your neighbor when you're not sure whether you love yourself? Because people don't like their hair, they don't like this, they want artificial this and this.
Want to get their nose fixed?
Then they're not. I can't see that they love themselves or they'd be content with the way they were created.
Okay.
Well, I think our world has changed so. And coming from a traditional family, mother, father, where they lived together till death, we can't afford it. But our children get married. And soon we have step grandchildren. We have they've married and divorced. So what can we do? Then pretty soon, they're the gay or the lesbian in the family. So what do we do? We have to show our love. And I have to accept things with step-grandchildren and maybe someone, a gay or lesbian. And so I think I change, not that I don't love. You know, I still love them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to learn. Like said, reading the tape or listening to the tape to understand where they're coming from.
And you have to be willing to be challenged.
That's right. Uh-huh.
And to be open to meeting that other person.
That's right.
Okay.
And we have to experience to take steps in understanding.
Yeah.
If we're just going to exclude, we'll never understand. We'll never be able to accept.
Okay. And I think this is part of what Jesus was getting at when, you know, with this whole notion of love is being willing to take these steps. To take the steps. Yeah, over.
Well, you had your hand up.
Yeah, but he's talked more than you have.
I was just going to say that politically, as Christians, we can't afford to let political parties define what a family is or what a family value is. I don't think we should listen to any of them about that. They might know other things in politics and economics and things, but I don't think they know diddly-poo about what a family is about. We shouldn't listen to them.
Thank you.